Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're revisiting our conversation with the showrunner, co-creator, and writer of the show Billions, Brian Koppelman. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review some new music from Mitski, Low Cut Connie, and the late Jamie Branch.
Of my glass with a little bit left, as I got older, I learned I'm a drinker. Sometimes a drink feels like family.
Family.
That's a little bit of Bug Like an Angel, a new track from Mitski and the new album, The Land is Inhospitable and So Are We.
What a title.
Wow. Mitski Miyawaki, first self-released two albums as a college student in 2012, 2013, studying music in college, of course, and then finally released a third studio album when she got out of school, Bury Me at Makeout Creek in 2014. That created quite a bit of buzz. She got signed by a really hip indie label, Dead Oceans, in 2015, and her subsequent albums have been on that label. Each one accruing in acclaim and sales, culminating with Laurel Hell in 2022. It seems like we just reviewed that album a few weeks ago.
Right? Yeah, it was a standout last year, and it shot to the top 10 in several countries.
Yeah, it came after a bit of a hiatus. She had contemplated maybe even giving up music between the release of her 2018 album and Laurel Hell. We're really glad she did decide to pursue that musical career. A song in 2022 was nominated for an Oscar, actually. This Is a Life from that film, Everything Everywhere All at Once. Mm. And now she's got a new album, which is unlike, you know, I don't want to play all her cards here, but it's unlike anything she's recorded so far. The Land is Inhospitable and So Are We. I mean, she went all out. Her producer, she's been working with Patrick Hyland for a number of years, but she's really expanded the scope of this record with the orchestration conducted by Drew Erickson, a full choir, 17 people,
yeah,
12
yeah.
in L.A., 5 in Nashville, all arranged by Mitski. It's been an incredible project. Let's play a bit of a song from it before we dive in. It's called Buffalo Replaced from Mitski on The Land is Inhospitable and So Are We.
That is Mitski with Buffalo Replaced from her seventh album, the indomitably titled The Land is Inhospitable, and So Are We. You know, Greg, we bumped in with that track, Bug Like an Angel, and that line just kills me. Anyone who has struggled with addiction or alcoholism or had a loved one do so. When she sings, sometimes a drink feels like family. And then suddenly the choir of angels
right.
shout, family, right? Mm-hmm. Oh my God. I mean, she had me literally, therefore, from the first 30 seconds. And I wouldn't have thought Mitski could surprise me or top Laurel Hell. Blew me away last year, wound up among my top records of 2022, but this is extraordinary. In terms of the ambition of the musical orchestrations. You know, it's like nobody's been doing this kind of super ambitious art pop since Bjork in her heyday. Mitski seems to keep getting drawn back to the music world, and that is to our benefit, because that mix of sour and sweet that we often talk about, where there is darkness. You know, at one point she sings, "Stride through the house naked. Don't even care that the curtains are open. Let the darkness see me." That darkness is never named. It, at another point, she tells us, awaits us all around the corner. I think the fact that it is not specific, all of us have that darkness just over our shoulder that we have to fight off at times. But then the sweetness, the beauty of the melodies, the power of her voice, this shows experience, it shows depth, it shows a breadth of vision. And, you know, I mean, look at her list of influences. Scott Walker and Stravinsky. Yeah. Carter Burwell, who did those great soundtracks for the Coen brothers, including Fargo, and Ennio Morricone. Mm. And let's not forget Caetano Veloso. Wow.
Yeah.
This is just supremely ambitious, and not just shooting for this kind of ambition and diversity, but succeeding with every song.
Yeah, it's kind of an opera, you know. It's that scale without the pretense of that. You know, you're absolutely right about, you know, the very first track, "Bug Like an Angel." If you're not smitten right away, I don't know. I can't help you. This is an incredible record from that standpoint. You know, I'm sort of, every song has something to recommend it. I love the range of music. There's some country stuff in here.
Yeah.
You know, there's
Pedal
there's,
Steel.
Yeah. There's a, you know, you look at a song like "I Don't Like My Mind." That to me is kind of like taking that whole, the guy at the end of the bar getting, you know, staring into his drink, trying to drown his despair. That's a new take on that whole tradition that's really fresh. The Deal, that song is basically a modern day version of Robert Johnson at the Crossroads. I sold my soul to the devil. I made this deal. And what's the consequence of that? The turbulence of that arrangement on that song, where it just flares out at the end, really striking, and then returns to that theme in that song, "I'm Your Man," where she's talking about the man is inside her head.
Yeah. That's again, that unspecified darkness.
This sort of biblical doom that's sort of lingering over everything. The man inside her head, the consequences that await him, the person in your head, for making that deal with the devil. So she's constantly wrestling with these big themes in really dramatic fashion, but at the same time, it's basically about love and hope.
Yeah.
And can we have those things in the times we live in? An incredible record from Mitski.
Oh, yeah, that was a little bit of "Tell Me Something I Don't Know" from the new album by Low Cut Connie. Art dealers, Greg, we have been fans of frontman Adam Wiener ever since we had him on Sound Opinions way back when in 2015, episode 519, and he rolled in his upright piano to the studios at Public Radio. Doesn't go anywhere without his beloved upright piano.
Taking a piano on tour, man, that's dedication.
That is, you know, all the punk bands jump in the back of the van, but to take a piano in the back of the van, Low Cut Connie is truly unique, and it really does revolve around Adam. I believe at this point he is the sole member who has been on all seven previous albums. This is their eighth. unique in the fact that everybody borrows from Nugget's Garage Rock 60s, but who goes back to Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard hammering away at the piano in the 50s? You know, the first generation rock and rollers, where before Chuck Berry made guitar the star of the show, hammering away on piano, and then the breadth of the songwriting. You know, this guy is a Hubert Selby Jr., or dare I say a Nick Tosches, of the grimy underside of American life, in particular that in New York City. We have a bit of a concept album for album number 8, Art Dealers, because Adam Wiener is dedicating it to Lou Reed. All right. Adam and Low Cut Connie are based in Philadelphia. He grew up in New Jersey, in the Philadelphia area. But he spent a lot of his formative years playing piano as a song and dance man. You know, playing in gay bars in New York, right? And this has always informed his ability to paint vivid pictures of people that he met in the New York night scene, right? The 3 a.m. and the bar has got last call. Let's play another song from Art Dealers and talk about what we think of this latest from Adam Wiener and Low Cut Connie. This is a track, this is the title track, in fact, Art Dealers on Sound Opinions.
When it shut down the store, all the art dealers don't live here no more.
That is Art Dealers, the title track from the new Low Cut Connie record. You know, I really thought that Adam Wiener took a huge stride in that previous record, Private Lives. That was, to me, you know, suddenly that music that sort of had been this sort of boozy bar band type thing, and done very well. I could
Bordering on shtick at times,
You know, I could see why he went over at a place like Pegasus in New York. You know, I had friends who went there to see him. He was a great... You know, you talk about a piano man, he took that to another level. And here he's really developed as a songwriter and a lyricist in particular. And you're right, this is sort of a concept record in terms of, you know, addressing that particular era that he was in. You had things like AIDS, which, you know, he's addressing in this song, you know, Art
Dealers. Title track is about the devastation of the artistic communities in New York by AIDS.
Right, and the song King of the Jews, you know, he's talking about what does it feel like to be an outsider? I mean, Adam is Jewish, and he's embracing that on this album in a big way. The feeling of being an outsider, you know, you're singing at a gay club, you're Jewish, you know, you're feeling... You know, like you don't belong sometimes, you know, and that's very
even
much
in
what
New
this
York.
Music is about, right? The album is addressing a lot of those themes, and the album ends on this really kind of somewhat devastating note. The party's over, even though it's a great song. It's a really stripped down piece where he's talking about, you know, kind of the state of America, you know, and... You know, I feel like a garbage man who's lost his wedding ring. You know, it's just like one of those things where you're, you know, that this late night, last song kind of deal at the bar as it's emptying out. And you feel like it's the end of the world in some ways, you know?
I feel like a garbage man who's lost his wedding ring. I guess the party's over.
It's an album that sort of runs the gamut from the highs to the lows and about what a wonderful time that was, but also being very frank and forthright about the feeling of loneliness and despair that has gone through the communities that he was playing for
well,
for
we
much
were
of
just,
his career.
Just talking before taping about how the COVID hangover is lingering. I think it's a hangover for Adam, too, and then you combine it... with the fact that we've had this before. Yeah. You know, it never seemed like we'd get out of the AIDS crisis, and so many were lost. But life goes on. Controversially, I think this is a better New York album than New York by Lou Reed.
Which, I figure that might come up. I know you don't like that record.
I don't like that record. Yeah. Last Great American Whale. Lou wrote fantastic songs about New York with the Velvet Underground, and in his solo career, the New York album wasn't his best. The lyric, I got to quote, "All the glitter in the world is made in a factory in New Jersey off Exit 9. Mm. Exit 9! I know it! Thank you, Adam, for that and for Art Dealers, a fantastic album. That's what we thought of the latest from Mitski and Low Cut Connie. But as always, we want to hear from you. Leave us a voice message with your thoughts on soundopinions.org. When we come back, another music review and a conversation with Brian Koppelman on Sound Opinions.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He is Jim DeRogatis. That's a little bit of a track called Baba Louie from the new Jamie Branch album, Fly or Die, Fly or Die, Fly or Die, three times. Jamie Branch, we have talked about her on the show in the past. I think I played her as a buried treasure a bit ago. She died in 2022 at the age of 39, a tragic death, in her apartment in Brooklyn. She had spent many years, though, in Chicago, classically trained trumpet player and composer, part of multiple scenes. She was in the Chicago jazz scene, as I mentioned, as well as New York and in Baltimore, and contributed to a wide range of projects since 2007. Not only in jazz, but punk, avant-garde, indie rock, you name it, Jamie had a hand in it. She's collaborated with artists like TV on the Radio and Spoon, in addition to developing her own career. She kind of established herself as a solo artist in recent years and maintained her Chicago connection. And as a matter of fact, you know, two key members of her band are Chicago-based musicians, Jason Ajamian on bass and the great drummer, Chad Taylor.
If you Chad Taylor, I'm glad you said it first because holy cow, what a genius.
If you see Chad's name on a record, you could probably purchase it because he's just done wonderful projects throughout his career. Anyway, so Jamie Branch, this is now a posthumous record, unfortunately, but the record had been pretty much done before she died, and it was a sudden death, and nobody expected it.
Her loved ones put it together based on, you know, it being fairly finished.
That's right. And it was a series of albums that she'd been creating with this band. Let's play a track from it before we review it. It's called Burning Gray from Jamie Branch's Fly or Die, Fly or Die, Fly or Die on Sound Opinions.
Burning Gray by Jamie Branch from an album so good you have to say the title three times in a row. Fly or Die, Fly or Die, Fly or Die. So I'm playing this for the seventh or eighth time around the house, Greg, making dinner, and went from that track, Burning Gray, into The Mountain, which I'll talk about in a second, and Carmel, my beloved, says, "What is this?" And I said, "Oh, it's a Kot thing." But it's great. Kot thing meaning you are the avant jazz beau of this duo. I respect that. You know, much of it I love too. And Jamie Branch is up there as that kind of genius. Holy cow. The easy comparison for jazz idiots like me is Electric Miles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Her influences ranged far and wide. Chad Taylor delivering those incredible world rhythms, the syncopated beats. You know, Don Cherry's in there every bit as much as Electric Miles. you know, what an extraordinary album. The instrumentals, which is about half of the record, are incredible. When Jamie herself sings, by no means is she a great singer.
Mm-hmm.
She is passionate.
Yeah.
She is calling for revolution. She is calling for reassessment. She is essentially shouting, right?
Mm-hmm. Gonna take over the world. Gonna take over the world. Give it back, 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 back to the Lord.
She has said in interviews that she tried to play the trumpet like she sang her soul, like she was singing her soul. And when she comes out with these lyrics calling for a radical reimagination of the state of our society, you know, she's undeniable, even if it's not the best singing in the world. And then, you know, I mentioned the segue from Burning Gray to The Mountain.
I have seen the information on the lighter side of dumbness. I have heard new statistics and the stomping on the ground picking slowly up.
That's a cover of a Meat Puppets song.
Yeah, right.
And where are the Meat Puppets coming in here? Well, if you go back to that SST kind of psychedelic indie punk heyday, you know, why did Kurt Cobain love the Meat Puppets so much? He gave half of his Unplugged show to them. You know, there was this jazzy influence, this psychedelic jazz, again, Electric Miles thing happening. It makes perfect sense. First time you hear it, it's jarring. The more you listen to the album, and there's other incredible left turns. I mean, I don't know of any other jazz albums that have a Mimbira, the Zimbabwe thumb piano on it.
Mm-hmm.
You probably do. But wow. Even if you think you don't like jazz, this is an incredible album.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth, Jim, because I'm, you know, trying to help you expand your vocabulary on jazz. And these are the kind of bands
that
are
good.
Well,
I'm younger than you, so I have time to catch up.
Well, you know, I think the time to start, you know, being caught is now.
Yeah.
This is gateway music for people who are kind of skeptical about jazz or not sure they're going to like it. To me, it just, you know, it blows the top of my head off. I don't care what my genre. Jamie skipped around between genres very freely and was interested in all that music. As you mentioned, the Meat Puppets being a reference point on this record. You know, when I listen to her music, I think of Antibalas or Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Yeah. Or Ken Vandermark.
There's a joy to it,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's rambunctious. You know, Chad Taylor's in that AACM kind of mold in Chicago bass.
He apparently has eight limbs. You know, I don't know how he's playing what he's playing.
And there's a cellist on this record, Lester St. Louis. Mm. I mean, the feedback on that cello is just like, what is that? It's electric guitar or something. It's just an amazing element of this. I'm glad you brought up the psychedelic element. I know you're a fan of that. But there's parts of these songs where it does get totally psychedelic.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you've got the pure mountain soul thing on the mountain, the song that you referenced, that cover of the Meat Puppets Coming Down. That is a huge range of stuff. But most of all, I think of these songs, and what just kills me about that track, Burning Gray, I wish I had the time, I wish I had the time, I wish I had the time of my life.
Yeah.
I wish I had the time. And this doesn't sound like, you know, Jamie knew she was on death's door. This sounds like a breakthrough album that was promising even more great music in the future. So that's the tragedy here. We're not going to get any more of that. But meanwhile, we have this great album.
Oh, absolutely right, Greg. Now we're going to revisit our conversation with music fan and sound opinions champion Brian Koppelman, showrunner, co-creator, and writer of Billions, which is airing its final season. We want to note this conversation was recorded back in 2018.
You came at me!
Because you're a criminal, Bob. And it's my job to shut him down and put him in jail.
Well, if that's true, you're not very good at it. You're also full of shit.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And this week we are joined by our guest, Brian Koppelman. Brian's the showrunner, co-creator, and executive producer of the super acclaimed Showtime series, Billions. You heard a clip from it just a minute ago. Damian Lewis plays Bobby Axelrod, a corrupt billionaire hedge fund manager. His nemesis, Paul Giamatti, is Chuck Rhodes, a U.S. attorney for the state of New York, the sovereign district of New York, Greg. He's hell-bent on indicting Axelrod for all sorts of crimes, but is he any less guilty himself? That's the whole show. Along with his writing partner, David Levine, Koppelman leads Billions both in incredible storytelling and in music.
That's right, Jim. That music is incredible, and Koppelman does an incredible job of selecting songs for the series that strike the mood of the scene and elevate the show as a whole, develop these characters. It's exactly the way you want to see music used in a long-form medium like the series. For the last 20 years, Koppelman has worked as a screenwriter, co-writing films like Rounders and Ocean's 13 and more. But I first met him in the early 90s when he was in the record business as an A&R guy, you know, basically a talent scout in the music industry. You know, and he's had a career there that's pretty estimable. He's worked with artists like Tracy Chapman, Metallica, Five for Fighting. The list goes on and on.
Let's also mention that Brian has a podcast of his own, Greg, The Moment with Brian Koppelman. Is that enough build-up, Brian? Welcome to Sound Opinions.
Hey, it's a thrill to be here, guys. I really never miss listening to an episode of the show. It's really important to me in my week-to-week life. So great to talk to you both.
Well, wait till what you have to say after we get done interviewing.
But we can only deflate that.
We appreciate it, Brian. You come from a musical background. I mean, you were 13, right? And you're managing bands or something and producing shows. Very early age, it seemed like this was your destiny.
Well, that's exactly right. My father was in the record business. He was a music publisher and sometime record producer. And I grew up really in a house that was filled with music, and I grew up going to recording studios with my father. I would listen to demos with my dad all the time. I would watch him help a producer coax a lead vocal out of a singer. And those were some of the most magical times of my life. That whole thing of living around music made it such a central part of my life and of my consciousness. And I really thought the A&R guys, my dad wasn't an A&R guy, and I really thought that being an A&R person, being the person who picks the music for the label and helps make the records, would get me as close to these artists I loved, and maybe I could help them. And so that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I geared my whole life towards. And yeah, I started managing bands when I was young, and I started going to recording studios with bands when I was young. And then, as you probably know, when I was at college, through a fortuitous series of events, I came across Tracy Chapman and began working with her. I'm generally credited with discovering her.
Yeah, I mean, you were still at Tufts University.
Yes.
And you managed to get Tracy signed.
Yes.
Wow.
And it was an incredible, life-changing thing. I mean, I've said this before, but it's really true. I was helping to organize an all-campus boycott of classes in order to lead the divestment movement, because I'm sure you guys remember what it was like in the late 80s in colleges, where they were all invested their endowments in corporations doing business in South Africa, and we were trying to stop that. And along the way, a friend of mine said, there's this singer you should get to play at the rally. And I went to see this singer, and it was Tracy Chapman. And she came out on stage, and she played Talking About a Revolution.
Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper?
And you got a picture being 19 years old and sitting there, now having a lifetime of being prepared for it. The advantages I've had, and it's something that I think white guys in their 50s don't talk about enough, but if you were a white guy growing up when we did and had the added advantages I did of the exposure to all this stuff, if you weren't prepared to leap at the opportunities, something was wrong with you, because we were given this incredible free pass in the world. The people of color and women just weren't then in the same way. And so I was really positioned by a lifetime of thinking about this stuff and by sort of like being around it to recognize what Tracy was doing. And I had the added benefit of being young and innocent in a certain way.
That's a selfless way to describe it, Brian. But the old school, I mean, you really are one of the last generation of the old school record company people, right?
Yes, that's
true. You know, they all talk about having ears. Did you ever consider, you know, what does that mean? That means the first time you heard Talking About a Revolution, you say, yeah.
I had always thought about that idea of would you recognize it, could you recognize it, could you see it? And but that's only part of that job. And what happened to me is I became quickly disillusioned by the machine of the record business, which is different now, but I think there's always some version of it. The machine of the record business was something I was bad at. And part of the reason I was bad at it was I had total sympathy for the artists. And I, for whatever reason, I found myself more interested in the process of how they wrote their songs than in talking to the promotion guy about how to get the song on the radio, which made me bad at the job. I was bad to the very artists that I loved. I couldn't do what they needed me to do. What they needed me to do was convince program directors to play their records. And all I wanted to do was hang around with them and talk about whether or not the bass should be on the Tonic. And that was not really what the job called for.
So, Brian, you leave the music industry, you get into writing for TV and movies. How did you make that transition?
Well, a few different things happened. I had started to get burned out and frustrated by, really, I thought I wasn't doing a very good job of balancing all these things in the way that I wanted to. And I really was not happy in the job. And then Amy, my wife, got pregnant with our first child and Sammy was born. And when he was born, I had this realization that I wanted to be the kind of father who would tell him to chase his dreams. And I realized that I wasn't. I was sitting in my office one night and I was never a cigarette smoker in my life. I got through 29 years of my life without ever smoking a cigarette, but I had just picked up the habit for a week. And I was smoking a cigarette in my office and I was eating like a cheeseburger at, you know, before dinner. And I realized I was unhappy and that I had to face the fact that I was a blocked screenwriter, that I was a blocked writer and that I really wanted to do this. And that if I didn't make this change and listen to the secret calling that I had in my heart, I would become something inside of me would die. And I felt like when something inside of you dies, like any other death, it's toxic. And I felt like that toxicity would bleed onto those people that I loved. And that instead of being a good father and husband, I'd become a bitter one. And that I had to find a way to make that change. And I went to Dave, who was my best friend. He was bartending. And I said, I'm ready to do this. Let's write a movie together. But I'm still blocked. I don't know how to like get out of this. And he gave me a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And I did the exercises in that book. And around that time, went into a poker club and called him in the middle of the night. And I said, I know what the movie is. And we then went into a basement and we wrote every morning before I went to work and after he bartended. And 4.5 months later, we came out with this finished screenplay for Rounders.
So Rounders comes out in 1998. You go on to write Ocean's 13, which comes out in 2007. In 2016, Billions. It's sort of this cat and mouse game between two alpha male characters, both trying to do what they believe is best for themselves, trying to win. It's set against this backdrop of Wall Street and the hedge funds and making as much money as possible. I want to talk about an iconic music moment in the show when you use Even the Losers by Tom Petty, Season 2, Episode 11. I don't want to give any spoilers, but how did that come together?
So that's a great one to talk about because that song, Even the Losers, was in the script right from the beginning. The moment we started writing the episode and we had the idea for what that episode would be, which is this, yeah, you're right, I don't want to spoil it, but which has a lot of reversals in it. That episode, it was clear to us. I remember writing Even the Losers into the script and knowing that that was going to be a very special part of it. Sitting with David, and we put that in and knew the way we were going to use that song throughout the episode. And when you have that kind of a feeling, it's like getting the idea for the big plot twist. It's the thing that makes the whole piece have a unified voice, a unified tone. And what a thing to be able to get that song and use it in that spot. And then, because of the world we live in now, to get to see people react to it.
That's really interesting because the friends I have who are in the movie and television business, right, it's kind of anathema, or it was for decades, that you shall not dictate what the songs will be, right? Usually it's like that's somebody else's job. We don't want to hear from you, showrunner, screenwriter, even director, what the music's going to be.
Well, In movies, that's true that the director picks it, although a screenwriter could indicate it. In television, the showrunner usually works with a music supervisor, and the music supervisor makes suggestions. But I do really give it a level of thought and focus. Yeah, the Showtime, they want the showrunners. I mean, look, think about how well David Chase used music on The Sopranos, or Matt Weiner used music on Mad Men. I think it is part of the job description. The question is, how deep is your knowledge? How obsessive are you about this stuff? And obviously, I'm a fanatic. You know what I mean? I'm never stopping thinking about music, listening to music, making lists of songs. You know, I have giant lists each season of songs to use, so that Dictator song that we used, or the Willie DeVille song, you know, what a thrill, as I'm sure it would be for you guys. What a thrill to put a Mink DeVille song on a Sunday night television show.
Yeah.
Hey, Mr. Jim, I can see the shape you're in. Finger on your eyebrow and left hand on your hip. Thinking that you're such a lady killer. Think you're so slick. Well, all right.
More people than he ever reached, probably.
And what's great to me is, you know, I could see on Twitter people going, what Lou Reed song is this? And it's like, and then I saw people who were like, hey, great use of Mink DeVille. And that's really satisfying to me.
Well, I think what's interesting to me is we're in this golden era of TV in the way it's using music as a plot point, as a character development point, you know, sort of a punctuation point. It seems like television now is at a point where the music is so integral to a lot of shows, yours included, that it's coming from these very astute kind of guys who are interested in not just cinema or TV or the visual aspects, but are deep, deep music geeks like yourself. The opportunity wasn't there, is what I'm saying, maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, sure, you're totally right. But and beyond that, the fact that there is Spotify and that there's streaming iTunes and that there's Pandora means that I have at my fingertips all the music, right?
Everything.
But the fact of the matter is that I'm able to go down these in a way that you couldn't. How would you do it 20 years ago? How would you remember, hey, wait, I think Spanish Stroll was Mink DeVille. Oh, where do I have that album? Oh, yeah, I had to move that to the store. How would you stumble upon? How would you find that?
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, like one of the music cues that people loved this year, and we used a lot of new ones. I think one I'm happiest about is the song that started the last season, was a song called Born in San Antone by a guy named Garrett T. Capps, who had 1,000 streams ever before the show, and then people lost their minds at what a cool song it was.
I was born in San Antone. I was born in San Antone. I guess that's why I'm a pink chip gringo. I was born in San Antone.
And that was just something that I stumbled upon on Spotify by just, it was in some recommendation algorithm and that song came on. And I remember getting it and sending it to Levine immediately and going, we're going to open the season with this song. I know exactly how to use it. And he heard it and he was like, we already wrote the scene that goes with it. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those incredible moments that never would have happened if we didn't live now.
And then he made 78 cents.
Right. No, but he was, but you know, you talk to that guy. And
he's
that
happy.
Changed his life.
Yes.
Jim.
Yes.
That really changed his life, right? That guy now had millions of people hear his song. It went up the chart on whatever the thing is where people check what the song is, Shazam. And it became, he had a little moment. And then it's up to him, right, to write all the other songs and get himself to where that pays off.
How difficult is the licensing landscape out there? Because I used to hear stories about how prohibitive it could be to use a song in a TV or a movie, and a lot of decisions were economic ones. How much is it that a factor? And say, you've had a Dylan song in every season.
We will always have a Dylan song.
Well chosen, by the way, and in key moments, I mean, Visions of Johanna. I love that song. I love the placement of it. That must have cost a lot of money. That's what I was thinking.
Well, there is. So it's not as prohibitive as it once was. But also, Showtime We make the show for a budget. We don't go over our budget. We're good partners, and they're good partners for us. We, at the beginning of this whole thing, said to Showtime, we're going to spend X on music and the show. Here's how we're going to use music. Here's why. And you guys are going to see that people are going to notice this, and it's going to be considered a real feature of the show. And they supported that. So that, and then after the first season, when it was clear that people were reacting to the music in that way, when we did that stuff and it worked, it created a belief in them. So that, now there are things like Led Zeppelin we haven't been able to figure out, though some people have. We haven't been able to figure out how to get a Zeppelin song in the show yet.
I can't understand how Sharp Objects has like 43 Zeppelin songs in every episode.
Yeah. Somehow we haven't been able to like figure it out because of the way you have to get clearances with them, which is like send them the...
You have to get personal approval.
Yeah, and the way we do our schedule on the show, it seems impossible. I'll tell you one that I loved, though, that I wouldn't have... That people really reacted to this year was I Wish I Was Your Mother by Mötley Crüe. That was another thing where we came across that song listening to some streaming service and hadn't heard it in a long time and knew the cover versions. And that opportunity to match what's going on in the show to this incredible song that music people know and love, but a lot of people don't know, and then to make that marriage happen, it's a huge privilege, man. I can't believe I get this. You know, the music geek in me. I can't believe I get to do this.
Is there one that's broken your heart? So you couldn't get Zeppelin, right?
I think the only song we couldn't get was the Zeppelin song.
Okay, all right.
Another part of it is I can, and this is a benefit of having grown up in the record business and working in it till I was 30. Is I do have the ability to reach out to people. And
you know,
make
a
special
guy.
Request a lot of the time. Do you know what I mean? So if it's really, we made a movie called Solitary Man and used the Johnny Cash version of the Neil Diamond song. And I remember it was impossible in the studio that we made that movie for. It was incredibly cheap and they wouldn't pay. But I remember the studio guitar. I remember John Leventhal, who played guitar, you know, Sean, who produced the Sean Colvin records and is married to Roseanne Cash. And I remember that I worked with John on a session once in the 90s. And I wrote him and reminded him, and then he asked Roseanne, and then Roseanne asked her brother, and then her brother was like, okay, I can figure out how to get you guys the master recording. And so you have to be super risk, like, I'll use anything I have to try to get the song if there's no other way to do it.
Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl who'll stay and won't play games behind me, I'll be what I am, a solitary man.
When we come back, Brian Koppelman will share some more behind-the-scenes information about Billions, and he'll reveal the secret to his creative success. That's on Sound Opinions.
A part-time thing.
And we're back. I wanted to know how Brian's past experiences as a screenwriter and director using music affected how he sees and uses music in Billions.
Yeah, each time you go, you learn. First of all, I guess it's watching movies, right? I mean, being obsessed by movies and music and books, that, you know, those things in comedy were like the things that I was obsessed about and geekish about and the pathetic New York Knicks for my whole life. And so, yeah, you're constantly studying and refining. I think what happened, though, is in the fourth episode of the first season of Billions, we use the Andrew Bird song, Oh No.
In the sauce of remains of what was thought, put, and said, all the calcified arithmetists were doing the math. And it would take a calculated blow to the head to light the eyes of all the homeless sociopaths.
And I remember finding the song and figuring out we could use it to begin and end the episode, and that the psychopath's line worked really well with what we were talking about on the show. And I remember Dave and I putting it up in the editing room and watching it, and that was really the roadmap. It was on the fourth episode when it locked in, and it was a light bulb moment for us where it was like, this is how we're going to use music. This is the way that we're going to deploy these songs, so that something in the way that the guitars are played, or something in the drums, or something in the lyrics, has to strike off the stuff happening on screen so that its resonance echoes, you know, so that its resonance grows. And that if we are obsessive enough to not stop until we create those moments, we would have the chance to make a show that would have an impact. And that was the moment that crystallized it.
Interesting. You know, I also think the choices are unconventional. Like, they're not exactly super obvious. Like, I thought a key scene for you, I think it was in the last season when Taylor is this non-binary character. I mean, that's
a gender non-binary. Yeah, Taylor Mason, played by Asia Kate Dillon, is a gender non-binary character. Yeah.
Amazing character, amazing addition to the show. The tryst that goes on involving Taylor, the track that you chose was The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen, and there's a conversation between the characters about that song and how they both connect to it,
yes.
Which wouldn't be the first song I'd say when, you know, like you're going to have a romantic moment, you know?
Under the blue moon I saw you, so soon you'll take me up in your arms, too late to beg you, or cancel it though I know it must be.
It struck me like, wow, that's cool. So are you making those musical choices and then writing the scene, or does the scene sort of inspire the song choice? How does that work?
I remember that. So Dave and I have a writing staff, some of whom write the first draft of episodes, and some of whom write episodes. And the writer of that episode had written that scene based on, you know, us all outlining it together, and he'd written the draft of the scene and then wrote... And a song plays that Brian and Dave will pick because you didn't want to put the thing in there. And I remember sitting with David, and we were kicking ideas back and forth. And I said, Killing Moon. And Dave immediately went, yes, oh, my God, Killing Moon. And then we played it in the room, you know, and read the scene while Killing Moon. We rewrote that scene, and then as we did and we put Killing Moon on in the room, it was just like clear. And then, you know, we had to find the perfect turntable. So then our prop person went and searched out the perfect turntable. And then we wrote that dialogue where they're talking about, can I put this on? Yeah, you know, it's exactly what I would have chosen. And we just had this feeling that then that song would suffuse the whole episode with a certain tone and a certain mood. And it plays at the end of the episode too. And it really works. But often we're trying many, many ideas. Once in a while, you'll get something like Sammy Davis Jr. Bojangles, which that also came right at the beginning. The moment we thought of that, the moment a writer said, what if we do this thing in a cemetery? I just put on Bojangles. And I was like, what if this plays?
That's great.
And everyone was like, what? With the whistling? Oh, my God. You know.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. In worn-out shoes.
It's incredible, but it does feel like a lifetime's pursuit of loving music so much. Like, I can't tell you guys, and this is why I'm so obsessed with your show, is that, you know, listening to people who feel about music the way I do, and that's why I've tweeted a few times, you know, I'm equally happy when I'm disagreeing with you.
Brian, I wanted to wrap up the interview by asking you your advice for all our listeners out there who have creative aspirations and maybe they don't know how to achieve them. Earlier, you mentioned the book The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron as the thing that really helped you reach the goal of becoming a successful screenwriter. The gist of it is, dream big, apply rigor, and take some sort of action every day to get you closer to your goal. What have you done today, Brian?
Well, I'm talking to you guys. This
many a star has
no,
been
you know
made
what,
on Sound
You know
Opinions.
What I do every day? I'll just say, for anyone out there, for anyone listening who like has some dream that most people would say was insane, which, you know, every single artist that you guys play on your show, every woman who picked up a guitar, every man who sat down at the piano had an unrealistic dream, an impossible idea that what they had to say or what they had to play mattered and meant something and might mean something to somebody else. This message of the ability to transcend your limitations and what you believe are your limitations.
Yeah.
And so, but what I do every day is every day I journal and every day I take a long walk and every day I meditate. And I do those things to get out of my conscious head that's telling me, who am I to think that I can do this special stuff? Who am I to think that what's in my imagination matters? And if I do those things, I can get the negative voices out of my head and I can center myself to move forward for the day. And so that's what I did today, and that's what I do every day. And listen to a lot of great music.
We have been talking to Brian Koppelman here on Sound Opinions, writer, producer, brilliant music lover, fan of Sound Opinions. That's the only flaw in his armor. Brian, thanks for coming on our show.
What a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
You know, Brian's one of those fellow music lovers, Greg, regardless of the Hollywood pedigree, that we could just talk to forever.
No, absolutely. Brian's a friend of the show, and we wish him luck on his next venture once Billions wraps up this season.
Enough with the rich people, though. I'm tired of TV shows about super rich. What do we have on the show next week, Greg?
We are going to go some more buried treasures, Jim. We're going to dig them out. There is so much great music coming out this year. We can't wait to tell you about it and hopefully turn some people onto under-the-radar tunes that are out there. And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Max Hatlam, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.